Hello and welcome to episode 3 of Janine Green Chats ASB. Today I'm really, really pleased to be joined by Craig Freeman, who is an ASB specialist. Now, anyone who's listened to the podcast episodes that I've recorded so far will know that they have been covered the community trigger, had Jenny Herrera along, the chief exec of ASB Help. And I was also joined by John Bull, a manager of Young Persons Drug and Alcohol Service. So we've done a little bit of chatting around support and intervention, and we've done a little bit of chatting around the community trigger and how that's played out and how that's working. And I wanted to take a slightly different slant today and look at some of the legal tools and powers that we use as ASB officers. Now, Craig's been doing a huge amount of work around the injunction specifically, does some great work on committal processes, dealing with breaches of injunctions. And I really wanted to get him along today to share with you some of his experiences, some of his learning, and hopefully some of the practical tips and advice that he's got to offer. It's fair to say that Craig is a little bit of a font of knowledge when it comes to injunctions. So absolutely no pressure at all then, Craig. Can I just ask you to introduce yourself and tell me a little bit more about your background?
Yeah, hi there. Yeah, good morning, Janine. Yeah, so Craig Freeman here, an ASB specialist. I currently work in the Buckinghamshire area. And I've worked in unsafe behaviour now for, well, since about 2005, where I began with the youth offending team. It was a part of the career, really, where I didn't really know where to take off, but essentially I wanted to stay in antisocial behaviour. I've kind of followed where the powers have gone. So I've gone from the community safety field into more direct local government, and then ended up working for a housing provider in social housing. So I've kind of followed where the powers have gone. I don't think that was my intention 15 years ago, but that's how the powers have gone, and they've shifted and I've gone along with it.
Fantastic. So 15 years, you've seen a huge amount of changes then in the community safety world. I suppose my first question is quite a broad question then. So what's been your observation since the introduction of the ASB Crime and Policing Act of 2014? How do you think we've seen ASB change and grow over the last few years?
Well, I think to really understand the ASB Crime Policing Act and how ASB has evolved, or whether it's not evolved, one must understand the politics behind antisocial behaviour. We all know it was Tony Blair's flagship legislation in the Crime Disorder Act, and it's tough on crime, tough on the causes of crime agenda that really influenced the so-called buzzwords in Britain's antisocial behaviour politics at the time and social policy that put ASB so high on the agenda, where for many years it really did stay. But since 2014, ASB hasn't really entered political discourse. Despite this, ASB has still evolved, although ASB hasn't really entered politics since and doesn't appear to be high on the agenda, presumably it might do after Brexit, maybe. But what we do know is ASB is no longer just low-level behaviour, and the police have less of a monopoly than ever before. It can consist of nearly any behaviour where there is a victim or so thought. The introduction of terms such as capable into the Act essentially says, OK, there doesn't need to be a victim as long as the behaviour was capable of causing antisocial behaviour. Then those relevant agencies can take action. Have the police lost all monopoly? Is that an automatic consequence of policing cuts? I'll probably say yes. Over the years, the powers have shifted from central government, where national objectives were being set, to the local government, and now to the estate holders, to housing associations. You asked a question of what's changed, but the buzzwords have disappeared. There's no more tough on crime agenda, no more ASBOs, no Home Office white paper titled Respect and Responsibility, Taking a Stand, etc. What we do have now is a small number of powers which are a result of the previous toolkit being streamlined. We have such powers as the injunction that you mentioned under Part 1 of the new Act, under the 2014 Act. The name of these powers have been watered down. There is no more badge of honour here. There is no more ASBO. Does the injunction have any real profile? In my experience, the injunction proven to be our strongest power to tackle individualistic behaviour.
So that's really interesting. I love the fact that we still refer to these as new tools and powers. I don't quite know when we're ever going to get over that now that we're, what, 5 years down the line?
Yep.
And I will say, Craig, this is a Brexit-free podcast episode. So it's a swear word as far as this podcast is concerned. We're not going down the Brexit route today. I just want to put on what you were saying there about the injunction. I mean, obviously, we know that from housing providers' point of view, they've had access to the injunction for a number of years. I mean, since 1996, when they were brought in for housing providers. And I think when you speak to most social housing providers, they will speak quite fondly of the injunction. And certainly when government went out to consult on the new legislation, the feedback from housing providers was overwhelmingly, you know, we like the injunction, please don't get rid of it. And so actually the approach that was taken was to widen it out and make it so that police could use it. Councils could use it even where they didn't have their own housing stock. I know you've got a huge amount of experience in using injunctions. Could you tell me a little bit more about the types of injunctions you've used, what kind of behaviours you've used them for, what kind of perpetrators you've used them to address?
Well, offender groups are really wide-ranging. Essentially, we just need a victim, or at least have the capability for there to be a victim. In other words, that behaviour must have the capability for someone to be affected. Most common offender groups, I mean, for us, we're currently working with, which is a huge business, but in County Drug Lines, gang members in the upper hierarchy, plotting members further down the ladder into small towns and cities to expand the drug network. It's a bit like pyramid setting, and it's very difficult to control. The impact on communities is absolutely devastating. So I've obtained a number of junctions with real creative terms to deal with behaviours associated with drug supply, for example, prohibiting the respondent from carrying or owning more than one mobile phone, or carrying more than £100 in cash, or from associating with other dealers. Exclusion zones are also ideal because they give communities a bit of a respite. Other offender groups, domestic violence, again, a huge area, a priority area for us at the moment. We have other powers already within the toolkit, such as the domestic violence protection notice and the subsequent order. Non-molestation orders, of course, are still available to be used. But there's quite a worrying number of victims of domestic violence that withdraw for their evidence and no longer wish to pursue criminal proceedings. You would think the offender would get off scot-free. Well, what about the impact on neighbours who can hear the violence, who feel intimidated and impacted in other ways, albeit indirectly? In the past month alone, I've committed one person to prison for 12 weeks and another for 56 days. These were exclusion zone breaches. We didn't want them there. We didn't want their behaviours affecting residents and the wider community. Using this angle, we were also protecting the victim, using the window of opportunity to really engage with the victim while the offender is in custody. 12 weeks in prison, as opposed to him getting off scot-free, not a bad outcome, in my opinion. He would have walked away with nothing, with no further action. Instead, he's in prison considering how he should conduct himself when he is released. And then we have injunctions against those who have engaged in more mainstream antisocial behaviour, human noise nuisance, late-night disturbances, disorderly behaviour, shouting, fighting, arguing, using foul language, intimidating or harassing residents. Some of it might be drug or alcohol fuelled. And we get terms to reflect this type of behaviour.
Fantastic. So I'm going to take you back there a little bit, because the first offender group that you talked about was kind of quite serious criminals in a sense. I mean, you were talking about gangs, you're talking about quite high level criminality. And I know there is a view from some people, some organisations, that that's crime. So that should be dealt with by the police. And, you know, injunctions are for ASB. I mean, what's your view on that? Why are you so much of an advocate of using the civil tools to deal with things that may traditionally be seen as being crimes?
Well, first and foremost, you're not just dealing with criminal matters. You are dealing with behaviours that might escalate into criminal matters. We're talking about the disturbances, the disorderly behaviour, some of the things that might fall through the cracks of criminal law. So the injunctions do play that part, but also people got to remember what injunctions are. They are a preventative tool. They are designed to tell somebody you are not to do this. You are not to engage in this behaviour, because when you do engage in this behaviour, you engage in very serious behaviour that has effect on people. In doing so, these injunctions are very preventative. If anything, I've said it before, but if anything, actually, if you get an injunction against one, for example, county drug dealer, and then don't get an injunction against another person who's involved in the county drug line, the person with the injunction has this advantage, because that person's being told not to engage in these behaviours. This is what's going to happen if you do engage in those behaviours. There could be requirements on there to deal with any issues around substance misuse, for example, or to engage them in more positive requirements. So that person has a real advantage to really get themselves out of that circle that they're currently operating in, and hopefully put them back on their feet again to live a risk-free future.
And I think sometimes that's the thing. I think we forget that there is this opportunity to use injunctions as a means of supporting people. And I think, you know, it's really important when we're working with partners who might believe that we're looking to criminalise people with injunctions, that we do remember that there is that real support element that can really help people. I mean, I have to say, I mean, I'm a huge advocate of using entire toolkits to address a problem, whether that's a criminal solution, a civil solution. It's kind of whatever works to stop the harm. And I've heard of many success stories where injunctions have been used against gang nominals, and it's really helped in terms of breaking some of their patterns of behaviour. So I think you're absolutely right, and I really do agree with a lot of the work you're doing around using some of these powers to address more higher level behaviour. Can you talk me through how that's going down with the courts, though? So where you are making applications for against gang nominals or more serious criminals, are you finding that the courts are welcoming of that, or are you finding there's some challenge there?
So we work closely with the Buckinghamshire courts, mainly Milton Keynes and Oxford. Back in 2015, really, because the injunction didn't. There was a 6-month delay there. So it was around late March in 2015 where we first obtained our injunction, and we just thought, well, it's a good case to do. It was involved a female who involved a knife and used that knife against a neighbour, and for whatever reason, it fell through the cracks of criminal legislation, namely due to there being no independent witnesses, but a civil standard. But we felt we had the right evidence to go to court. One of our concerns are the courts going to be welcoming, and how would they deal with, firstly, the application for the injunction, and secondly, how would they deal with a breach? And I think for the first year, and by the 12th month, I think we probably obtained maybe about 12 injunctions in that first year. And we had a number of committals, and from those committals, we knew we had to sit down with the court and say, okay, look, we think these can be processed better. We think these can be dealt with better. The good news is that the courts are very welcoming, and they wanted that conversation, and they welcomed that conversation. And we went along to the court user groups, and we made sure that the agreement that we had in place, you know, continued to be carried out, and it was being followed by court staff. So, you know, there's some real, you know, technical matters. For example, can a district judge, you know, deal with the matter? Do they have delegated powers? You know, because we don't want our cases being appealed or being dismissed because it was there was a procedural irregularity there. You know, so I think one of the issues that we really do have is around, nationally, I wouldn't say we, but nationally, one of the issues from the feedback that I get is around courts really beginning to scrutinise a power of arrest. The criteria for a power of arrest order is clearly defined within the Act in Section 4, that being the use of threat, use of violence, or that there being a significant risk of harm to others. And that risk of harm is again clearly defined within the Act of Section 20, which states the risk of harm can be caused by ill treatment or abuse, whether physical or not. Many ASB officers and police officers that I've spoken to have concerned themselves with the element of the job, or the element of the case, where there's violence. And if there is no violence, then the power of arrest simply isn't applied for. this can't be right. This cannot be right. Of course, proving the risk of harm might be tricky. When obtaining statements, it's absolutely imperative that the risk of harm and the effect of that harm is evident. If the victim has been assaulted or threatened, then this might be slightly easier to prove, but consideration should really be given to those victims who can't, for example, sleep at night due to noise or late night disturbances, and as such struggle to function the following day, or those victims whose mental state has deteriorated. Are they on medication as a result of the behaviour? Are the children struggling at school because of the behaviour? Are the parents struggling to perform at work? Only last week I took a statement down from a victim. She was a nurse at a local hospital. She was suffering nuisance from the neighbour, general disorder throughout the night. When I obtained the statement, we really honed in on the impact. She couldn't sleep at night. She couldn't function at work the next day. She was working with vulnerable people, and she said her boss had warned her because she had looked tired and wasn't focused. In this example, the risk had extended to the patients at the hospital who were in the care of our victim. So we used that as an angle, and the judge is absolutely right to go with it. There's a real focus in on the impact, and we have to be quite creative at times to make sure that we do meet the definitions within the Act.
I think it's a really good point. Obviously I work with a lot of clients myself, and I review quite a lot of witness statements, and I still see witness statements that are written to very, very well describe the incidents that have happened, and then they just stop. There's no kind of explanation of the impact that's been had on themselves or their family. And as you said, some of that stuff is really, really powerful. And when we're dealing with definitions that relate to how it makes somebody feel, then actually the impact is so, so very important to get across. So I think you're absolutely right there. And I would encourage anyone listening that where they are putting evidence together, whether that be for gaining a legal order or whether that be for dealing with the brief, that they make sure that the impact is adequately covered, because it's so important and so powerful. I want to talk a little bit about, I know you've used without notice injunctions as well. Could you just, I think, first of all, just to make sure that we're all on the same page, could you just very quickly sum up what we mean by without notice injunction, and then perhaps tell us a little bit about the types of situations you've used them for?
Yeah, so in order to go without notice, you're really relying on there being some kind of urgency to get to court. You're relying on really there being a risk of harm to somebody, and you can't wait 2 weeks for a hearing. But there are various procedures that you can rely on. You do have your without notice procedure. You do have another procedure within the civil procedure rules to go what they call informal notice, or what, as we call it, short notice, which means the defendant or the respondent still gets notice, but actually you're asking the court to list a hearing within a few days. Or otherwise you're just going with notice, and you're being potentially waited a couple of weeks for a hearing. To go without notice, you are relying on there to be some kind of urgency. There has to be a risk of harm. But that risk of harm can be to you, to the ASP officer. It can be to the police officer who's got to serve those papers. And the reason why I say that for is because we ought to be protected as well. If you've got a respondent who is 24 hours earlier, he got arrested and he kicked off with a police officer. Recently, I obtained an injunction and I went without notice because... And at the time I did think, you know, are we going to get this one through? And I wasn't concerned because we just come back for the with notice hearing if we didn't get the without notice application. But the judge went with it because he could see that we couldn't possibly serve his papers on him safely without being assaulted by this person, because he was such a violent person. So we can be very creative around that. But for me, without notice, the more mainstream cases are, for example, domestic violence. And we will go and get an injunction to exclude that person without notice from the area. Last week, we had a very interesting case where we had a household who had decided to pick up a load of machetes and knives, and four people out of that household, so four people out of five, had gone into the neighbour's property at 11:30 at night and decided to kick the door down and enter the property. And there were various assaults that took place, and unfortunately, someone got slashed with a knife. They were all arrested, but they were bailed by police, and we were concerned actually that those bail conditions didn't do enough to protect the victims. So we went without notice and excluded the family from the property, okay, all bar one person who I felt we could keep there. But four out of the five were excluded from the property. And that was without notice. They had absolutely no idea we were going to court. Again, that's such a high threshold. I mean, the fact that you excluded some of those members from their own home, from their usual premises where they live. But to do that without notice, so essentially turning up on their doorstep and saying, you've got to leave, it's such a huge threshold. But the courts are going with it, okay? And rightly so. The judge made absolutely the right judgment. The judge brought it back quickly, and of course, there's no real prejudice because the defendant can apply to various sets of the order with short notice anyway. But our view is we can't manage the risk. So we quite rightly made the application that we did, and we got it.
I think that's the thing. I mean, I know obviously exclusions from home, particularly on a without notice basis, are, as you say, you know, they're really challenging to get that kind of condition in a without notice injunction. But as you say, if the situation is serious enough and you can justify the reason why you're making that decision, then there will be situations where the courts will find in your favour and will allow that term to go into the without notice injunction. So I think it's just about being proportionate, isn't it, and recognising the cases where it's right to ask the question. I just want to pick up a couple of things that you said there, because I think they're really important. I just want to reiterate them. So you mentioned about the fact that you use without notice injunctions quite regularly for where your own staff or contractors have been threatened. And I think, I mean, certainly, I've worked in ASB for 15 years as well, and certainly that's where I've personally used them probably the most, and where I've seen them used the most is where it's been staff that's threatened. And I guess, although we're getting better, I think there is still a little bit of this view that if you're an ASB officer, then you have to put up with a certain amount of abuse or behaviour towards you because of the job you do, and therefore you should just put up with it. And I really want to just challenge that view. If you work for an organisation where that view still exists, then that really needs to be challenged. Because as you say, Craig, you know, we can use the injunction to protect our staff, and it's right to do so. And we've seen other areas of ASB legislation that have been tightened up to protect staff. So, you know, we saw the changes to the discretionary ground for ASB that now includes the fact that behaviour towards staff is a breach of tenancy, regardless of whether it happened in the locality or not. So I really encourage people to make sure that we don't slip into this mindset of being complacent about behaviour towards staff and thinking that it's okay to do. The other thing that I picked up there, Craig, which I'm really glad you mentioned, was about using injunctions even where there are bail conditions in place. And I know that there are some organisations that believe that if there are bail conditions in place, then getting an injunction would just duplicate and therefore be a waste of time. Do you mind just expanding a little bit more on why you feel the need to look at injunctions as, even where there are bail conditions? What benefit do you think the injunction gives you over the bail conditions that might be in place?
Well, it's a good question, and it's not an easy one to answer because every case will be different. The reason why I went to court last week and got four injunctions without notice was because I didn't really agree with the bail conditions that were in place. So a police bail, they are enforceable. It's not a criminal offence. But there's a lot of changes around the Bail Act as of April last year, I think it was. So not everyone's getting bailed. Police bail is actually quite a rarity these days. As such, there is a displacement there because we don't want people going back to their own home where there's been a set of behaviours that's affected neighbours, and there's a risk of harm that remains despite the person being arrested. Just because someone's been arrested doesn't mean that the risk of harm is gone. So you take last week's case, for example. I simply went to court because I didn't want them at that property, and the police bail did nothing or did not reflect whether they should be able to stay at that property or not. And the next door neighbour were the victims. I wasn't satisfied. I wasn't comfortable with them being there. The risk hadn't changed, in my opinion. I felt I was right to take to court. The good news is that the courts aren't questioning that. The courts totally understand that police bail conditions can change from one minute to the next. At least with a civil injunction, we have some control over it.
Great, thank you. I'm going to stick with the police for a moment before we move on to look at kind of committal and breaches of injunctions. I think One of the observations that we have seen with the new legislation is that although the police now do have the legal recourse to seek the injunction themselves, actually the rates of application from the police are incredibly low. I just wondered if you could offer some observations on why you think those rates are low and maybe how you think we can encourage police colleagues to start perhaps using the power themselves a little more.
Yeah, I don't really know many police areas or police forces that are using the injunction power. I work in the Thames Valley Police area. I work alongside some fantastic teams and fantastic officers, and I know that they are keen to start using these powers. But there has been a concern about the effectiveness of the injunction. And when I began working in Buckinghamshire about 5 years ago, nearly, just before the 2014 Act came into play, before it was introduced, I was quite keen to use the power. It didn't take long for me to realise actually that it's a very good power to use if used correctly. And I wanted to share those successes with the agencies that we work closely with, especially those who are tasked with enforcing those orders. So we work really closely with Thames Valley Police now, and I have done for many years, a fantastic LPA. And our injunction procedure is totally embedded within their own procedure. That power is totally embedded in their work, and they rely on it. They see it as being a very useful tool, and there's going to be some big changes over the next few months in respect to how different agencies in the area are going to start using this power.
Fantastic. So, how do you think you've managed to win their hearts and minds? Is it about, because you talked about effectiveness there and there is some concern, and certainly I know some police officers who hate the injunction, think it's awful, a waste of time, takes a long time to get, isn't effective in terms of sanctions. Is it a matter of showing the benefits of these tools? Is that how you've managed to win the hearts and minds of these officers?
I think when you see big names go away for a long time. We're talking about individuals who have engaged in unsuspicious behaviour for a very long time, that they haven't gone away for years. When the magistrate court has dealt with them, they've dealt with them and they've been told to stay in custody for the rest of the day, and then they get released or they get 7 days in prison or a very short sentence. And then we get an injunction against that same person and we deal with them completely differently. There's one particular person I've got in mind right now, which really got the ball rolling a few years ago, where he was subject to a criminal behaviour order. And every time he got breached something like 12, 13 times. He's the most arrested man in Britain at one point. But he was never in prison. He was never, ever in prison. And there's just this real high demand on dealing with him. And he never went away. And we got an injunction against him. And within 4 weeks of that injunction, he was in prison for 9 months. And then subsequently, he spent another 3 months in prison in total after that. So for the first year almost of the injunction being obtained, he spent the majority of that behind bars due to the injunction and him breaching that injunction. And that kind of paved the way for us to start looking at it more so. And Thames Valley Police looked at it more so and start to realise, well, actually, are these powers actually better than what we think they are? The process is something that we have to talk about, because I think that there's a bit of lack of knowledge here, but that should never be confused with, well, if we don't understand how it works, then we shouldn't use them. Thames Valley Police was so brilliant, and I can't praise them more, because I actually wanted to learn more about the process so they could really back us up in enforcing these powers and do it quickly and robustly, and that's exactly what we've done.
I think you're right. There's something about, you know, all taking joint responsibility for kind of raising awareness, because, I mean, one of the things that we can't get away from is when these powers came in, you know, you talk about the injunction coming in March 2015, there was no training offered alongside the tools coming in. So it was almost felt, without any disrespect to our government, it almost felt very much like we've made these changes, now get on and do them. There was no training offered. There was very little in the way of real guidance. I mean, the statutory guidance is there, but let's be honest, as a practitioner, it's not giving you a step-by-step process of how to use the injunction. And I think it's very challenging, therefore, to take an organisation that, like the police, that are used to working within criminal law, and expect them to just suddenly start using civil tools and powers. I think is that realistic? They're probably very much not. And I think the approach that you've taken, which is around sharing knowledge, you know, educating partners, is clearly showing dividends. And I always encourage, and anyone listening now, I would encourage to kind of go out to partners and try and raise awareness through joint briefings or awareness sessions, because I think that's the only way, as you say, that you're going to bring these tools into the forefront of other people's minds.
Yeah, absolutely. And also it has to be a mindset issue there as well, because we understand as you know, being a housing provider, that Tenant Valley Police would have to come to us and say, actually, you know, we want to learn from you. And that's a big deal. So partnership working there is very good. It's a very effective relationship that we have. And in doing so, it just means that we can really get behind the powers that we use and a much wider toolkit as well.
Fantastic. So we've talked a little bit about the types of injunctions you've used. We talked a little bit about the types of behaviours, the offenders that you've used them for. We talked a little bit about without notice, a little bit about power of arrest. I just want to, therefore, the logical kind of step in my questions is to start thinking about, you know, what happens when the injunctions don't work and there are breaches? Because I think inevitably, particularly as you say, when you're dealing with some quite high level offenders, you are going to have breaches of the orders. That's inevitable. And I understand that in the area that you work in, that you've got quite a unique partnership in terms of how you deal with breaches of injunctions and committal processes. So can you tell me a little bit more about that?
In relation to the actual partnership with that, Janine?
Yeah, so how you deal with your breaches of injunctions?
We have an effective relationship with LPA, within Tenant Valley Police down here. It's probably the most effective partnership that I've worked in, and I've worked in so many very good partnerships over the years. But it really is truly a pretty unique partnership, to the extent that Tenant Valley Police within the Aylesbury LPA have a dedicated team that will work closely with agencies such as us to enforce these court orders, especially in the context of antisocial behaviour. Teams know who is responsible in completing the papers. I take a lot of that burden off them, because I will deal with the papers, bearing in mind we're the claimant, we have to do that. And I created a procedure a few years ago, which we still follow now. When there's an arrest, there is a clear task separation. Communication is needed, and communication has always been very good, but everyone knows their role. There are difficulties, of course. For example, some housing associations have come to us and they've said, well, we work across 20 or 25 police force areas. And building relationships up in each area can create an effective to create an effective partnership can't be easy. And then you get the more logistical issues of responding to an injunction breach and getting to court at short notice. Not every organisation has an in-house legal team, for example. And as such, might find it difficult instructing a lawyer at short notice. And then that raises the question of, will non-qualified persons be given a right of audience, even if it's just to get the matter adjourned? But of course, they want matters to be dealt with straight away if they can. Other barriers, there are access to legal aid issues. I entirely took the view 3 years ago that this was a completely broken system. However, we've worked hard to engage with local law firms. So we're not just having to work with Tenant Valley Police as an agency, but we've had to work hard with local law firms and find out who might be willing to act. So when a person is arrested, I would give the prisoner a legal aid notification form, as per last year's case in James and James, making it very clear he had an entitlement, in fact, a fundamental human right to be represented. And I'd also give the prisoner the list of local law firms. It took some time to convince law firms.
A little bit there, Craig, because I know there's going to be a question in people's minds at the moment, which is, why, if you're the applicant, would you be helping the respondent effectively by giving them details of where they can seek legal aid?
Well, first and foremost, everyone has to be treated fairly. It's a fundamental human right. But it's your case. The last thing you want to be doing is going to court and that person not being represented and then wants to be represented. Now, if I don't want to be represented, then fine. I've had defendants who have turned up before and said, no, just go on with it. And they've told the judge, look, I don't want to be represented. I'm going to prison anyway, or whatever the case might be. But sometimes they don't want to be represented and they will do it themselves. And that's fine. That's their decision. But if they want to be represented, then that's their right. So why would I wait till court to offer that? They're going to be offered it anyway. So let's make sure it gets dealt with as soon as possible. If we can find them, and I wouldn't necessarily give them a particular law firm to work with, but I'll give them a list of local law firms. And it took some time to convince law firms, both with a criminal certificate, that they could act. And the case of Brown and Haringey has helped that. But really, we want our defendants to be represented, and they've got to be treated fairly. We don't want cases to get adjourned and adjourned and adjourned because they haven't got representation. So if we can push them in that direction, if they want to be represented, then it helps us as well.
Can I take a step back? Because I'm conscious of the fact that for some of our listeners, using injunctions, and then particularly breaches of injunctions, might be something that's quite new to them. So just to kind of set a little bit of context, can you just explain the different ways in which breaches of injunctions can be dealt with?
There are two main methods that you have. The main method is really the one where there's a power of arrest attached. All our injunctions have a power of arrest attached. We have tried it once by simply making an application to the court for a hearing to be listed. I'm not a fan of that procedure, and I'll be avoiding that wherever I can going forward, and I have. But the main procedure really is the one where there's a power of arrest attached. It's quite a simple procedure. The respondent will get arrested if there's reasonable cause to suspect that that person breached the injunction. The decision then gets made as to whether that person needs to be interviewed. Is there evidence to preserve from the interview? Is the question that we'd ask ourselves. Is there any real benefit? And then we have 24 hours from the point of the arrest to produce that person to the court. And then, of course, we start asking ourselves some more questions, and that's really something for me to deal with, is where is there going to be a circuit judge available? But really, because I don't really want to go for another district judge because I don't know how to delegate powers. So for me, it is really a case of working with your local police team, who's been tasked with enforcing the injunction. There'll be times when I'll actually spend the whole day down in the police station, and I'll actually do the paperwork down there while that person's being interviewed downstairs. They'll come out, they'll take a break, the officers might speak to me and say, well, this is the response so far, do you want to ask any more questions? And then I might assist with the PACE interview. And that's perfectly fine, and it's worked very well. But really, it's just about partnership working, and we haven't lost a single thing. So out of the 50 or 60 committals that we've had, every single one of them has either faced going to prison or had a sentence suspended, which I think speaks volumes.
Absolutely. I want to talk a little bit more about power of arrest. You've touched on there, you know, some of the key positives of having a power of arrest, which, I mean, really, really relates to the speed in which breaches can be dealt with. And I think there's also something quite powerful in terms of both the perception of the respondent and the perception of residents if a uniformed police officer turns up soon after a breach and that person is arrested. I think that's quite impactful. And also quite reassuring for the community. So we know there's lots of positives in terms of having a power of arrest. But I have to say in the 15 years that I've worked in ASB, when I talk to people about what the biggest challenges are, power of arrest processes are very often raised as being a real challenge in terms of response officers going out to a breach, not knowing there's an injunction in place, or not knowing what an injunction is, and therefore no arrest is taking place, or an arrest occurs and then they you know, try and do them for a breach of an ASBO, so they start putting a case file together for a criminal matter, not bringing them to court within that 24-hour period, so therefore it falls apart. So there are lots of challenges as well. What's your experience of those, and how you've managed to get to this position where you clearly have a process that has managed to overcome some of those challenges?
Well, I've carried out force-wide training. There is a turnover of police officers, so we accept that there are always going to be officers that we deal with who might not necessarily have that training. But we have carried out force-wide training, and we tend to roll that back out every 6 months or so. But I think when we have the power of arrest, the guidance notes are there. A lot of it's about communication. I think agencies will do well, I think, to make sure that there's somebody who can be contacted almost on an on-call basis, even if it's just to have that 10-minute conversation with a custody officer, for example, that says, you know what, we've got one of your guys in custody at the moment. We don't know what we want to do next. You know, what are your thoughts? You're the claimant, you know, and that's kind of the question that we might get asked. And really, we go through the evidence at that point and we discuss whether that person should be interviewed. We look at the what statements have been obtained and who is obtaining them. And we really focus in on the impact on those statements. And everyone's had training in respect to that. We don't really have many issues around power of arrest, but that's because we really did set those foundations many years ago. We continue to do that now. Even in the last few weeks, I've rolled out training to various LPAs within Thames Valley Police because they want to make sure that when they enforce these power of arrest, that they do it properly and they do it procedurally and they do it without there being any risk or any procedural irregularities. We think actually that we've got it spot on here, but of course things might change and we'll have to roll with it. But at the moment, things are going well in that respect.
So communication for you is the biggie.
Absolutely.
I suppose that can be done on a case by case basis as well, can't it? So I suppose it underpins really the importance that if you are seeking an injunction against an individual, that real partnership work happens from the very beginning of the case so that everyone's clear in terms of the action that's being taken and the role that everybody needs to play in that. So actually, when you're talking to partners at the very beginning about seeking an injunction, could you have a conversation at that stage about how the process is going to work should there be any breaches? It's that proactive starting and flow of conversation, isn't it?
It really is. And just bear in mind, I mean, like many breaches can be dealt with retrospectively. We don't ever expect police officers to turn their back on a breach. If they attend an incident, someone's in the exclusion zone, they shouldn't be, they're kicking off, they've got to be arrested there and then. There's none of this, okay, look, we'll deal with you voluntarily, you know, a voluntary interview, that's what I mean. But we will never support that, okay? If someone's in breach, officers attend, they arrest them there and then. But actually what might happen is that we deal with it retrospectively, and many cases we can. So, for example, a report's been made we're dealing with it at a time. Police haven't attended because they turned up too late or whatever. Then we'll start looking at, well, let's get the evidence together. If there's no risk at this moment in time, let's spend the day to get the evidence together and we'll come back. A lot of it will be about the respondent. Who is that respondent? If it's somebody that we think that we'll never find again, okay, that person's going to go into hiding. We want that person to be arrested the moment the police officer who's with that person. But normally, 9 times out of 10, we know who they are. We know where to find them. And as such, we'll deal with it retrospectively. So it gives us a chance to work with the problem-solving team at Thames Valley Police who are dedicated and very specific to enforcing these orders. And they're absolutely fantastic down there. And so even if a shift officer does go out and deal with a report, it will always get passed back to the problem solving team anyway to go back and deal with the actual breach in terms of producing to court, in terms of obtaining statements. Of course, we can take statements down as well with a claimant. Of course, we can take those statements down as well if we want to. So a lot of it is just about communication. And the good thing about working with the problem solving team at CVP is that they will contact us. They'll say, look, Craig, this is the situation. The person's in custody right now. Are you happy for us to do A, B, C? Okay. And then generally we just go through what's going to happen over the next couple of hours and then always set like a schedule, I suppose, of what's going to happen over the course of that person being in custody. Ultimately, that person needs to be produced to court. In doing so, the clock, you know, starts and we have to do our paperwork and make sure that everything, all the boxes are ticked. But communication is absolutely key.
Can I pick up on something that you mentioned there? So you talked about breach of injunction in terms of someone going into their exclusion zone. And I very often hear people refer to those kind of breaches as technical breaches. So it's a breach of the injunction, but because they haven't actually been causing any problems, then should that be dealt with because it's literally them stepping into an exclusion zone? I mean, what's your view on that? It sounds to me like your view is it's a breach of injunction, so it should be dealt with. But so that can be quite a controversial view, with some people thinking that's a bit disproportionate. What's your take on that?
And my take on it is that if you've got an exclusion zone, it's because at some point in your case file, you have referred to antisocial behaviour that's affected others. You take an example of one exclusion zone where there's a family area, it's a family scheme, and kids would normally come outside and play. Well, if that person enters the exclusion zone, is there going to be some alarm? Well, there is. You know, we expect there to be some alarm, and we expect parents to come out, grab their kids, take them inside, etc. And all that will be in the court file, or the effect of him, that person being within that area would be in the court file, leading up to the breach. So, for me, exclusion zone breaches, they can be very serious. Sometimes we might look at it and say, well, actually, well, you know what, mate, maybe we don't need to deal with it by the committal. Just give that person a warning, for example. A lot of it depends on our evidence as well, but really, you know what, I think actually entering an exclusion zone is damn serious, and actually it needs to be dealt with, because people are living in that area, and that exclusion zone was normally given, was normally granted, because that community deserves a bit of respite, and they're not getting it if that person just keep coming back.
I am nodding my head vigorously at this point. I totally agree with you, and I think that's the main takeaway, isn't it? Which is, there is a reason why that exclusion zone was granted in the first place. You know, it would have had to have been shown in the evidence that there has been serious problems in that area for that exclusion to have been granted. And I think, therefore, anybody who's been a victim of that behaviour, just sheerly seeing the perpetrator enter in the area is going to be enough to cause harassment, alarm, and distress, as you mentioned. So I totally agree with you. And I think, you know, we talked about sentencing guidelines before. You know, the sentencing guidelines reflect that. The sentencing guidelines don't, you know, distinguish between technical breaches and non-technical breaches. I want to also pick up on another concern, which is around breaches and injunctions. So when the legislation was coming in 2014 and it was going through consultation, one of the concerns of practitioners was around the absolute ground for possession being a possible consequence of an injunction breach, where it relates to a tenant or their household members or visitors. And I think there was this little bit of a concern that judges might be reluctant to grant an injunction, knowing that it could possibly lead to eviction if it was breached. And yeah. I just wonder whether you've ever come across that, a judge who's shown some reluctance because they fear they're going to start this domino effect of ultimately getting a family evicted. Is that something you've come across?
I haven't. I think the court is very aware, because we work mainly with Buckinghamshire courts, and the courts are fully aware of what our policy is. And we have a policy, and I created this a few years ago. And it was on the back of some information that we became aware of, that other agencies were beginning to use the injunction as a shortcut to evict people. In other words, to be in that territory of absolute ground for possession. It's something that I can't agree with. A trivial breach of an injunction shouldn't necessarily mean that they should lose their home. Our policy is something that I created. My employer is very game for it, as they normally are when it comes to creating ASB procedures, etc. But our policy was, it simply says that actually, you know what, if there's a trivial breach, we will allow three separate breaches of an injunction before ground 7A kicks in. Unless one of those injunction breaches includes violence or serious harassment, or there remains a very serious or imminent risk of harm, in which case we can just activate ground 7A, or we can start using ground 7A straight away. So essentially, we do give three opportunities for an injunction to be complied with. That means three committals, providing those committals don't involve violence or serious harassment. But if they do, then we're going to give the opportunity for that person to stay in their home as long as possible. At the end of the day, we get these injunctions in place to keep people in their homes. Okay, we don't always get them against social housing tenants. Some of them will be against other members of the public who affect our tenants, who affect our residents. But if we get an injunction against somebody who is our tenant, we're doing it because we're trying to keep that person in their home.
Absolutely. I think there's two takeaways there, isn't there? Which is, so the first is that we're not seeing the problem that we perhaps worried that we would in terms of judges being more reluctant to grant injunctions. And the second thing there, which I think is important about so many different areas of ASB case management, which is just because we can do something doesn't mean we have to. And it's about what's proportionate and what's right and what's appropriate for each case in turn. So just because someone breaches an injunction which leaves us able to use the absolute ground of possession, it shouldn't be an automatic. It shouldn't be a, well, that's our next step because it's available to us. There should be some consideration about whether it's right to do. So I just before we finish, Craig, I want to give you the opportunity to talk about an exciting event that you've got coming up in a few weeks' time. I know that you're holding a seminar where you can share much more detail about some of the things that we've been discussing today. And I know you've got some really excellent speakers. So I just wanted to give you a few moments to talk about that event to make our listeners aware.
Yeah, so I own a business called Frontline Resolution, and it engages in work around providing training in health for agencies that are able to use the toolkit, injunctions, etc. But we have a seminar coming up on the 24th of September. It's at the Oculus Theatre. It's a lecture theatre down at Aylesbury Vale District Council. We have some excellent speakers from, in my opinion, some of the best barristers in the country, property litigation solicitors, and other trained providers and consultants and specialists within the field of antisocial behaviour. It's looking to be a very, very positive day, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of learning material that's going to come out of that. There are still tickets available, and I encourage anybody who wants to attend to get in touch, and they can do so by emailing me at info@frontlineresolution.co.uk.
Fantastic. So if that sounds of interest to anybody, then I would encourage you to get in contact with Craig and find out a little bit more. The other thing that I'll be doing is when I share this podcast episode with those of you that are on my mailing list, I will include details of how you can get to the booking site so you can book yourself a space. And if you're not part of my mailing list, then I would encourage you to go to my website, www.janinegreenasb.co.uk, where you can sign up and you'll get first dibs on things like podcast episodes, blog posts, guidance, etc., etc. So, Craig, it just leads me to say a huge thank you for your time. One of the things that we will be doing is putting a blog post together and some of the kind of top tips that Craig has shared. So that'll be circulated soon. But I can't end, Craig, without saying a huge thank you for your time and your clear experience. It's been really useful and really interesting speaking to you. So thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
And to all the listeners listening, then I look forward to speaking to you on the next podcast episode. Should you have any thoughts about people that you'd like to hear me interviewing or subject topics that you'd like to hear me covering, then by all means, reach out and drop me some notes. But other than that, thank you very much.